Welcome back to Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and today I am joined by the man long identified as, quote, Andy Cohen's best friend. He's also close friends with Sarah Jessica Parker, the Beverly Hills Housewives, and been photographed on Barry Diller's yacht. All of this to say, who exactly is Bruce Bozzi? You might know him from running the Palm Restaurant Group, his SiriusXM show Lunch with Bruce, or for being married to one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, Brian Lord. We're getting into all of this and more. Hey, Bruce Bozzi.
Hi, this is great. Thank you.
Of course. I'm so happy to see you and talk to you. I feel like I know you. It's so interesting. So, you know, how most people know you is twofold. Number one, you were the executive vice president of the Palm Restaurants across, was it nationwide?
It was nationwide. At one point, it was international with two franchises in Mexico, and we opened in London, which didn't work well for us, but we tried. It was very difficult doing business across the Atlantic. But at one point, there were 31 locations. You know, starting really just from one restaurant on Second Avenue in Manhattan that my great grandfather and his partner started in 1926, and unfortunately wrapped up. It's no longer in our family, but it was an incredible 30-year career for me and for our families.
If I put myself in your shoes, you know, part of this family business, you were fourth generation. Are you, or were you, in the middle, like at the midst of like a little bit of an identity crisis as far as like what to do, like what's going to be the next chapter? Like, have you begun to think about that?
Sure. Yeah, I have. I mean, one of the things I always ask myself is, how is this going to end? Like, how does this story conclude? It's 94 years, you know, assuming that one day we would sell the business, my family would make money, the other family would make money. And, you know, yet again, sort of the danger in family businesses, and it's a story told many times, is, you know, it can get ugly. And this got ugly between really based from the other family, but there were a number of things that came into play. So I thought, okay, what am I going to do? What do I want to do? And I had been thinking about it for a while, and I was able to reinvent the Palm about 10 or 12 years ago with a refresher of the brand. And it was wonderful. And I became sort of the face of the company and really told the story that, you know what, this is a family business, and family businesses don't really exist much in America anymore. They, you know, get bought up or they go away. And so I don't know. I hope to figure it out. I mean, right now I just say I'm unemployed. Who knows?
So I want to kind of like get your backstory. You were born in New York City?
I was born in New York City. My parents are third generation New Yorkers. I was born in Queens. We lived in Jackson Heights roughly till I was around 9 years old. And then we moved into Manhattan. And I went to elementary school in Manhattan. I went to high school. I went to Riverdale Country School. Then I had always dreamed about Los Angeles and California. I grew up really primarily with influenced by television in the 70s. So a lot of like Eight is Enough, a lot of Three's Company, a lot of Charlie's Angels. And my dream was to get out there. The 80s came. I went out in 84 to USC. Thought I was in heaven. 84 to 88. Came back to New York. Was a page at NBC for a year,
Can we talk about that? I want to hear your stories for being a page. Were you working for like Letterman or SNL?
Yeah. So basically, that program was amazing. Very hard to get into. You had a number of interviews, and when you got in, you got in. So your primary responsibility day to day, you had the outfit, and you gave tours. You gave tours of NBC. And it was, you know, exhilarating. You had like tours roughly between like 15 and 17 people. It was 1989. So pre-security, pre all the crazy things. And then the extra parts of your day were like when you had to do audience services. So my main gig was, you know, Saturday I'd give tours all day, and then we would go have a break and we'd work Saturday Night Live. And it was the year, for those of you listening, that Saturday Night Live celebrated its 15th anniversary. So that was the 15th year. And it was the year Gilda Radner died and we were there. And
oh, wow. So wait, so the year that you were working there, do you remember the cast?
Yeah. Oh, I should. Dennis Miller, because he used to make fun of my hair. Because I had all this big, you know, 80s hair. Yeah.
Was it Kevin Nealon?
Yes, Kevin Nealon. What's his face who died, whose wife killed him?
Philip Hartman.
Yep, Philip Hartman. It was unlike anything. So my job was, it was called the eighth floor. And so the eighth floor was coveted because you had the list for the, to get through. And we would be like, no, you're not on our list. Sorry. And people would, we had the power you wielded. So I did that. Letterman was on the sixth floor, right across from local news, Live at Five with Sue Simmons. So hello, crazy. And I often got the job where you stood between the audience and Letterman's desk. And there, it was kind of crazy. Robert Morton was the EP, and it was, I'll tell you two stories, like one big story. So like, and it was the coolest job because you just were like there. Betty Davis was on, it was 1989. She was really old. She was going to be honored at, Lincoln Center. Across the hall was Audrey Hepburn as a guest on, Live at Five. I basically was with, because I also had the Today Show assignment that summer. So I was getting to work at 6 a.m. So she knew me from the morning, and she was really into me because her sister was like, she really likes guys. And I was like, okay. So I was like, Betty Davis's guy. Then live, and like, and then she's like, and I'm standing, no joke. And this was the beauty of the program, because you were like, you were a fly in the wall and the most intense, like Brandon Tartikoff was running it. It was really a special moment. And I was standing between Audrey Hepburn and Betty Davis having a conversation and me. And you're just like, wow. So that job to me to this day at 54 was the best job I've ever had.
Did you ever have any interaction with Letterman?
I did, but not a lot. You were very, you know, at the time you were given a couple of instructions. Don't look him in the eye when he walked by. He did not want eye contact. And just to be really sort of like cool and laid back around it. Like he was the king of the castle there, and you knew just, okay, you did not want to get in the way of that.
Letterman was everything. Like even when I was a kid, you know, when I started watching him, I think he had just left his NBC show and he had jumped over to CBS. But so I like followed him through that whole transition, and like Letterman was everything. Oh.
Everything. He was so quick, so smart, so great. I remember that. I remember watching that first show on CBS when they transitioned over, because he thought he was going to get Carson's spot. They gave it to Jay Leno, and he was just like, okay, I got to go and give him this big deal. But so it was like, I did Donahue, because he was shooting on the eighth floor. So I would do Donahue. I would do Letterman. I did the Today Show assignment, which nobody wanted because it was early in the morning. And I did it during the summer. So I, you know, by the time I finished that assignment, which was they were 8-week assignments, everybody in, that I was in the program with was interviewing to be a part of it, because I would come up with these stories of like, oh, I got stuck in an elevator with Winona Ryder, or I was wheeling Shelley Winters around and crashed into like the wall because she couldn't walk and she, you know, to get her to makeup, or I had a million funny stories. And at the very end of that, and I think this was really the lesson that I learned, you know, I was really in charge of the green room. And as you know, the green room is like everyone, they come, they check in, you have to make sure they get the makeup, you make sure they have stuff to eat, you make the coffee, you have the pastries, you know, the senior producers in there typing scripts, because scripts are changing left and right as news comes in and you're running it in. And the very last day, Jane Pauley is sitting at the desk and she's applying her lipstick and she's just getting ready to go on air. And she goes, so I hear today's your last day on the Today Show. And I said, yeah. I go, it's been great. And she's like, would you like me to write you a recommendation? And I looked at her and I said, well, yes, of course. But, you know, all I really did was get people coffee and make sure they were in the studio on time. And she said, and this is a lesson to all of you young people, it's not what you did, it's how you did it, Bruce. And you came to work every day with a great attitude. I never said, hi, Jane. I always said, hi, Miss Pauley. Mr. Gumbel, I just knew, and I said, and I still have it like in a frame, and it was truly great. And then I just,
you should post that online.
I should post that. You know what? You're right. That would be a good thing to share with people. Yeah. And then I moved to LA. Then I was like, you know what? I want to get back to LA. I thought that was like the motherland for me. And I went back out there, and I was there about 4 years. It was really great, but it was really about me becoming comfortable with my sexuality, making friends who were gay. I didn't have gay friends. I needed to get away from my city and my home. And after 4 years, and it was a wonderful 4 years, and it was when 4 years felt like 4 years as opposed to 2 months because, you know, you're young. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to New York, never thinking I'd move back to LA. And of course,
wow,
you never know. You never know what happens.
So earlier when I said, like, you're really well known for two things. Number one, obviously, the legacy of The Palm. And number two, most famously, Andy Cohen's best friend. I mean, never has there been a best friend. I guess like Oprah and Gail. Like, she
really... Oh my God, that's great!
He has, like, he really has, like, elevated you. I mean, Jesus Christ, you're on radio show. Like, he really, like, gave you a nice platform to sort of expose your talents.
He, you know what? First of all, I love the comparison because I love them both, Gail and Oprah. But, you know, he did. And, like, you know, and it was... Andy and I, we met... Well, I moved back from L.A. and I was dating this guy who happened to be Andy's best friend. And it was 1994 and I met Andy. And over the next 3 years of this relationship, not only was Andy a pain in the ass because he was a shit stirrer in this relationship, but every time I knew we saw Andy, this guy and I were going to get into a fight. Because Andy would be like, oh, do you know so-and-so? And it would be someone I dated, like, you know, 4 years before. And I was, you know, would always get me in trouble. And from that birthed this incredible friendship. And Andy's rise and, you know, always a hard worker. I mean, none of us saw that coming. And when Andy started to do Watch What Happens Live in a little nook of NBC, Bravo, and then he did. He basically, it was astounding to me when people would be like, hey, you're Andy's best friend. You're Andy, you know, Andy Cohen. I was like, wow, people really noticed. And then he did give me this platform for the radio show. And he was always a big supporter with me in The Palm. I mean, he was a senior producer at CBS and we do cooking segments, or he really helped me.
Was that his job when you first met him, producer at CBS?
He was a producer at CBS on the early show basically.
And you would do cooking segments?
He then got, like, Mark McEwen, amazing, who was, like, their host, and he would book me, and they, you know, and it got, he started to get The Palm some play on that part. And then when he transitioned into being an executive and on-air talent, and then and, you know, with the show and the bartending, and it's been kind of great. I mean, I love it. Sometimes I get a little, like, it's freaked out by it, but it's awesome. And the radio show has afforded me this, like, and I think, and I don't know how you feel about it, I love talking to people and I love meeting people. So combining with what for The Palm and for me, and then as The Palm started to shift and I said, well, this isn't going to go, I kind of said, let's really kind of brand it more Lunch with Bruce and have some fun.
The precursor to Andy getting his one night a week doing Watch What Happens Live was he used to write this blog for BravoTV.com.
Where
he would basically keep a diary. It was not only was it the precursor for Watch What Happens Live, it was the precursor to his diaries. And he basically used to, like, do, like, a recap of all the shenanigans that he would get up to and all the people in his life. And you were a very heavy figure in that. So much, like, Bruce was like a full-blown character. You can still find these blog posts on BravoTV.com. And so much so that I guess the webmaster at the time, I think, was like, we need to flesh this out more. And there is literally a post that says, who the hell is Bruce? And it's like a showcase on you.
It really is. It was very funny. And now that you say that, and I completely forgot that Andy would, like, write about his cab ride up to 30 Rock. And, like, if the cab driver was rude and, like, or if the cab was smelly and, like, all these, like, crazy things. And when I saw that, who the hell is Bruce? I thought, of course, it's a very valid question. Who the hell is Bruce Bosley? And, like, how is he in the zeitgeist of this? But,
so
yes.
Funny. So you guys, so I guess, like, paint me a picture of, like, you and Andy in the day. Like, where were you guys living in the city? Like, where were your apartments? Was he, like, in the West Village at that point or someplace else?
Yeah, Andy was always the king of the West Village. He moved there. He lived way back when on Washington Place, like right around where Florent used to be off of Gainsborough, that whole area, right? So this was a rental building that they were going on sale. And he said to his mother, and it was a great, and Andy has an annual Christmas party from, like, that point when he was 25 to now when he's 52. Like, it's just part of his thing. And so we'd all smush in, and the apartment went up for sale for $175,000. And his mother was like, are you crazy? That much money? That's ridiculous.
Can you imagine?
And we, can you imagine? Yeah. Like, right? We're like, great. So he always loved, that was like his hood. And then I was living on 21st Street between 9th and 10th Avenue before 10th Avenue was anything. It was the late 90s. It was dark over there. You know, yet again, who knew if I had, you know, some shekels, I could have bought something there. So we were close and we were all like kind of running around there. And then when my relationship ended, Andy and I kind of coined, it was 1997. And we were like two peas in a pod. Like we just went to Miami. These guys coined us Brandy, Bruce and Andy. We were like, oh my God, how did we never think about Brandy? You know, and we just really went full stream ahead.
Why didn't you guys ever date, or did you?
We didn't date. I mean, one of the things I think, and people often ask that, and you know, they just were so connected. There's a moment where I think, you know, not only was I in the relationship first, but then when it transitioned into like a very, very close friendship, you know, there was, I mean, I cannot not say there was not a lot of chemistry. And because I think even in any sort of friendship, there's so much chemistry. And I think we just were a little bit potentially fearful that dating would impede the friendship that had become so great and profound. And I don't think we were really ready in a way. I think that, you know, Andy was kind of, we were both kind of figuring out who we were. You know, hindsight's 2020, who knows? But I love him. He's part of me. So I think it just was one of those things that didn't happen. But life, I mean, I'm married. So, yeah. You know, my husband always says, that's your husband, Andy. And he's right. Like, and he often will say, when I die, I know what's going to happen. You and Andy will be together and you'll be married. And we laugh.
Like, where did you guys used to go out? Like, what restaurants? Like, I guess this was, yeah, so the late 90s. Like, where were you going out? Like, who were you seeing? Like, I know he has that story about, like, seeing Warhol. What were, like, the highlights of the 90s?
Well, what happened was, so in the 90s, what happened, so in the early 90s, I was in LA and I didn't know Andy, right? And I call them my Norma Jean years that transitioning into Maryland. So in those years, I became friendly with Barry Diller and David Geffen and Liza Persky and Sandy Gowan, like all these people, and was running around. And when I went back east, those friendships continued. So when we kind of hooked in, we were, you know, every Sunday, Saturday and Sunday, we were at Floron having brunch, or we were at G if we were going out, or we were at the Roxy if we wanted to go dancing, or we were at a house party, or we were out in, because we rented that house in Sag Harbor, we rented a couple years together. And then he kind of continued it on, so he has it.
I'm so glad you brought this up about the house in Sag Harbor, because I was actually going to ask you about this. The two of you guys actually rented it back in the 90s, and that is still the house that he's in to this day.
Yeah, and to this day.
Does he now own it, or does he rent it?
No. So the house, we found the house. It's called and Haganach, we call it. And we rented it as a group, like a group rental, summer of 94, summer of 95, summer of 96, right? Summer of 96. Seven, relationship's over, he's still in it, there's a couple people, then he's getting successful enough that he can actually afford, it's not very expensive, there's a family that owns it, they're based in Pennsylvania, lovely couple, it's been in their family for generations. He asked, he was like, over the years, he's like, can I please just buy it? And they just were like, we don't want to sell it. So he never, you know, it was a perfect house. It's a perfect house for him. It's right on the water, like on the sound, and it's quiet, and he loves it. But now he has a son, and they're in it this summer, but he's soon outgrowing that house. And a beautiful, I mean, like I was over there the other night and we were having dinner. He cooked me dinner and he was like, we were looking around and we were like, we had a lot of summers here. You know, we had a lot of good times in this place. So it served way beyond its, you know, purpose.
Tell me how the Hamptons itself has changed since the 90s.
I'll tell you. Well, okay. So we started coming out as a family in the 70s. And then in the 80s, when I was like a teenager and I was in college, that's when I really like hit clubs that are long gone. In the 80s was that sort of time. And it was like, it was the 80s. So like there was a lot of, you know, I was working at the Palm at the Hunting Inn and it was filled with models and Christie Brinkley and Billy Joel. And, you know, it was Kathleen Turner. It was really just a great time. The 90s, transition into the 90s, different feel. Now I'm in my early 30s, late 20s, early 30s. And, you know, we're now a group of guys and we're hanging out. And, you know, there was, for us, clubs like the Swamp, that was still a gay club out here. That was amazing. It's where we learned Princess Diana died. We were very upset that night. Andy and I, we were having dinner in Sag Harbor at the, what's that diner that was used to be there? You might remember it. I think what's really changed is wealth seems to have just gotten out of control out here. So you have this, you know, a phrase that I hate, which is sort of like the top 1%, the percent of the percent. I feel like money has become a big thing. And I think that it's more crowded. It's always was crowded, but it's really crowded. People got, you know, to me, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world is the eastern end of Long Island and the beaches. And if you could find your nook and have this, your great house and your friends. So I think what's really changed is we grew up a little bit and, you know, more like socializing with people at their homes and lunches and stuff like that. And Andy, who is the most social, you know, driving around, visiting friends, he's really great about that. But, you know, less driving and, you know, the drinking, driving, you know, we got serious about things.
You mentioned your husband. So you're married to Brian Lord, who is he ostensibly the head of CIA?
Yes. He and his two partners, Kevin Uvane and Richard Lovett, are certainly the three partners, and they run Creative Artists Agency now and sort of do everything and, yes, are in charge of that company.
And is he Madonna's agent?
Well, Madonna's a client, and Madonna, I mean, he knows Madonna for many, 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 many years, right? So he knows Madonna from way back. And he, I wouldn't say, no, this woman named Maha, who is a great agent at CAA, is that's her day-to-day, you know, agent and her person. But, you know, so like Brian's clients, because, you know, though he's the partner, so he runs the business, his clients would be people like George Clooney and Daniel Craig and Scarlett Johansson. And those are, you know, Brian is an avid, you have to read if you really want to be a good agent. You must read. And so he's involved, of course, in every aspect of, he's a big deal.
I want to hear, so the reason why I bring up Madonna is because I am a super fan like you are. And it's, from what I can tell, she's in love with you. And I want to hear, I mean, I've seen these pictures of like your arm is around her waist and I've seen the you and Andy parting in Paris. Like, I guess like you had gone to see her show. Like, do you have your first memories of like getting into her and like this was the one?
Yeah, I do. So you go back. Okay. So it's early 90s. I'm living in LA. It's a whole different vibe in LA in the early 90s. And it's a great vibe. It's like New York was a little bit, it was in a recession. It was a darker time in New York and a lot of people were out there. And I kind of danced around a group of people. I was friends with Ingrid Casares. So of course that's like one degree away from Madonna. Her births, and you know, there was always like August birthday parties. I'd see her at Club Louie, which was a big club with Sandra Bernhardt, but there was no interaction. It was more like, I'm starstruck. Then you kind of fast forward. And the first time before I was with Brian, Stephen Klein, I got to know Stephen Klein, and he was like, he goes, do you want to come out? And I'm going out with a group of friends. Do you want to come out? And I go, yeah, great, great. Well, he was going out. It was a party for the album that Madonna was releasing, which may be one of her best. It was just like at that perfect moment. She had just turned 50. Jump.
Confessions.
Yeah. Right. So we were there. And also I'm in this like small club in New York and we're dancing. Like we are dancing. She's dancing. All her people are dancing. Cut to. Then I'm with Brian. And like now she starts to feel, you know, and I'm just a fan and she knows it and she loves it. So like for instant, we have always a big party at our house and she was all dressed up. And that's, you've seen some pictures of me that I posted and I literally had her coat. I held her coat the whole night and she just like got the biggest kick. And when she was leaving, she was like, you know, she took her coat. She's like, I'll be right back. And she gives me a big wink like this, like, you know, saying adios. We connected because I went to Milan to see her with Brian. Paris, we went with, it was Andy, it was Mark Consuelos and Kelly Ripa. It was Anderson and Benjamin, and we all went. We had a great time. We have a connection. We've made out. We've literally made out. I was not expecting it.
Where did you make out?
We made out at the Vanity Fair party. 1 year, we were all like talking, and I said, "Hi, Madonna," and she was like, "Hi," and I like just reached out to hold her hand. She was like, "You're just gonna hold my hand?" And I go, "Oh, you know, no, of course not." And I go in for a kiss, full tongue. I'm like, "Oh my god!" And then we went in again, and Brian happens to always kind of just miss it because he's looking the other way, and he'd be so furious. And then he finds out, and he's just like, "You know, I can't take you anywhere without you getting into some sort of trouble." So Madonna, I adore, and like you, you know, and I got to say about Madonna, and I just want to say it with you. In the early 90s, if you were gay, what Madonna did for the LGBTQ community at a time where we were still struggling with a lot of fear with AIDS, there was no cocktail that really came to light in 1996. Her videos were quite, you know, she really pushed the limit. Of course, she was just like, you know, gay men especially love that, you know, that woman, the changing of the look and the, you know, the whole the thing that we get into. And then, and she just, it was insistent and on pushing people to the limits. And when Truth or Dare came out and Alec Kashishian did that documentary, it was like life altering. And I always say she did so much, and she gets a lot of shit now. She's a little bit of a gazunta. She's wearing the braids. You know, we don't know what's exactly going on with the face, but we love her, and she's post getting a little cutty, nutty on Instagram. But she's always number one.
Like, don't you? This is how I feel. Don't you agree? I mean, I don't want to put the words in your mouth. Don't you agree? But like, the way I feel is a Madonna, a Cher. I mean, the rest of them like are sort of no longer with us, but like, these type of legends should not be accessible on Instagram. Like Janet Jackson, Prince, George Michael in the day. It was the mystery and the enigma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're like, do we really need to see a selfie in the bathroom? Like, it kills it a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think you're hitting on a point that's really interesting in regard to, for not only for them, but really for many of us in the world of, I think that you're right. Part of the allure of being a celebrity, part of the allure of being a sex symbol, part of the allure of everything is less is more. And so in a time before social media and specifically Instagram, but you know, the paparazzi were crazy. They'd catch celebrities like looking, you know, not great and stuff like that. So we went into that mode, but they were still iconic. I agree. Now, I don't think Cher's on Instagram either. I think George Michael, unfortunately, you know, he left us too soon. Whitney Houston, you know, she fell off a cliff. I think Madonna specifically, and I always say this, it's unfortunate, and I can't begin to sort of analyze it because I don't think you and I can have any inkling of what it's like to be that person who becomes that famous for so long, and what's the transition when you're on the other side of that. And, you know, from my perspective, I go, if you had kept, you know, did less work to your face, kept your body sort of lean and mean, and like had this Greta Garbo-esque, you know, transition into your career, wow, you know. But, you know, I guess a pop icon kind of wants to hold on to that. But I do think less is more, and it does diminish them as they get older. But what it also does is to the next generation, you know, my nephews who are like, you know, You know, you have Billie Eilish now, who's very different, but Lady Gaga, who's absolutely amazing. You know what I mean? And Gaga, I think, will go into being the pop star, into more of the sort of like standard Billie Holiday, Dinah Washington-esque sort of like really Greta Garbo-like thing. But yeah, I think, and specifically with Madonna, with no disrespect, and now you can't take away, you know, all of us from whatever we've done, you know, your achievements. I don't think she's doing herself any favors posting herself in a tub or like holding her breath, because first of all, it doesn't really look real and looks weird and she looks a little kooky, and it's, you know, I mean, I don't particularly enjoy that piece.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah, I didn't follow her for a while. Like, I stopped because I was like, yeah, I had to, like, stop because, like, I couldn't get them. And I went back, but I needed a break because of the face. You know, I was getting freaked out a little bit. But, you know, but, like, you know, all she does has to do is, and she's done it recently, is, you know, I didn't really, the Madame X tour was, I thought, a little kooky.
You didn't like it?
I liked it. You know what? I don't know if I liked it so much because I feel that, I think that yet again she presents herself in a way that I think it's somewhat, it's so stupid, it's ageist and it's not meant to be, but it's like you just, oh, you're doing cartwheels around the stage, and it just, I don't know, I don't like the mask, I don't like the fishnets with the things and the, it's me, you know what, I got the
eye patch. You don't like, you don't like,
yeah,
the eye patch.
Yeah, I don't like the eye patch. So I did give the money to do that. Remember that little stint?
The Polaroid?
I got the Polaroid and I framed it.
Amazing. See, you will do it. You will partake to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, even though we've recorded, it's my voice, I'm going to say it wasn't me. Somehow you asked somebody else to do this interview. Just kidding. It's so Madonna, funny. I love you. I love you, Madonna.
Curious to know, like, how long have you been with Brian and how did you guys meet?
We met, we're going on 14 years. We're married roughly, I think, going on 5. We met years before we had a mutual friend. Barry Diller was a very good friend of both of ours. I was sort of the East Coast version. Once I moved east, then he was the West Coast. And just over time, the groups of friends kept sort of, you know, coming together. And then there was always a lot of, I always had a lot of feelings towards Brian, as did I think many people. And we just, you could feel the chemistry with somebody. And then I had decided when I was turning 40 to become a father. And I met with a friend of mine, and she said, there's an agency called Growing Generations. You can do this. So I started the process. Brian and I started to date. Like, I ran into Brian, and I just said, look, this is the deal. You know, this is how I feel. And he said, this is how I feel. So, and Billy at the time was 13. And the rest is sort of history.
So, okay, so there's two things here. I guess, first of all, I want to hear about your decision to become a father. Because initially, were you with Brian or no? Like, you initially had Ava as a single father.
Initially, the decision, the commitment, the signing of the contracts, the sort of, you know, picking the egg donor, picking the surrogate, the meetings, the facilitated meetings, I did solo. I was not 100%. Brian and I were not a couple. Then very quickly we became a couple just because that's how the time. So before anything sort of medically was done, we were a couple. So as far as we're both concerned, you know, she wasn't conceived yet and we were together as a family. And then she was conceived and we had roughly 10 months as just a couple without a child, but with a teenager because I was, you know, coming back and forth. I was still based in New York. And once the baby was born, I relocated to LA and, cause we had a teenager and a baby. And so, yeah. So, but I was never a really single father. Brian and I were together.
I think, you know, when Andy announced that he was going to be a dad, I think that was a huge cultural shift. Like, did you always want to be a father? Like, how did it happen?
Yeah, it's interesting. The timing's interesting because Andy and I had these conversations many, many years ago. So in my 30s, I had, and my friends reminded me in my 20s and my 30s, you know, as I was in my 40s, you know, you always talked about becoming a dad. And I said, I did. And they said, yeah. And in my mid to late 30s, I started to just kind of look at surrogacy. IVF was not really on the table for gay people. And then all of a sudden, I put it aside and this conversation happened with my friend and she said, this is happening. And literally from that conversation, which was a lunch here in Los Angeles at Chin Chin, because I was here visiting for work for the LA Palm, that from that conversation, Ava was born 13 months later. So like I just immediately knew and it was visceral. I called up Andy. I was living between DC and New York for Palm stuff. I called him up and I said, I have something to tell you. He goes, do not tell me you're going to have a child. You're planning on doing this. We were going to do this together. And I said, I am going to do this now. I need, you know, this is my time to do this. And he understood. And in those 10 years where I became a father, he became Andy Cohen, the beloved Andy Cohen. So we had a different, that decade was two different decades for us. And, you know, we talked a lot about it over the last 4 years for Andy, because he was concerned about it and his work and his life and being a single man and like how this was going to play itself out. And from my experience, Ava's his goddaughter, and he watched. And funnily enough, Ava goes to her doctor every year. And her doctor said to me 3 days ago, because Wyatt now Cooper is in the world, mm-hmm. and Benjamin Cohen is in the world. She said, you were the trendsetter with your friends, and they saw how it was, and here they are starting their family. So it was good. And yeah, it just was timing. It was timing. And I always knew. And I'm just fortunate that we live in a time, and, you know, I'm fortunate that, you know, marriage equality happened, that the Supreme Court is, you know, in this crazy conservative weird time, holding up some of these things. It's scary, but, you know, I feel very blessed, because my friends who, like Barry and Sandy, who are now in their 70s, who were in their 50s when I met, this wasn't on the table for them. They had, you know, this was time. Yeah.
You made reference to, you know, having a teenager in the mix, and that woman, that person is Billy Lord, who is the daughter of Brian and Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
Which is a whole wild story in itself. Basically, your husband were they married, he and Carrie Fisher?
They were not married, but, you know, they were together and, you know, were, you know, yes, but they never legally got married.
And I remember in the Carrie Fisher documentary, that HBO doc, Bright Lights,
yes.
It was like Carrie
yes.
Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. At one point, she's like sort of like demonstrating to like to the document or to like to the director, like just how sort of chaotic and like almost like soap opera like her whole family history is, and she literally draws on a diagram like all the people
yeah.
in her family who have dated and her friends, and there's like Brian Lord, like your husband, just like he's the father of her daughter.
So, it's crazy.
So like Carrie Fisher must have, I mean, I assume that they remained very close.
Yes, I mean, you know, like any relationship, there were complexities to it. Carrie was truly an amazing person. And I knew going in, or I didn't know, but my gut said, you know, I'd never been in a relationship with anyone who had a kid. So all of a sudden I realized one day when I was looking at them, like, oh, I'm in a relationship with two people here. And it's probably more important that my relationship with my step or soon to be or one day stepdaughter is important. It's very, you know, because if that doesn't work, nothing will work, you know. And for anybody who's in a relationship with someone who has divorced, who has kids, you need to know that. And I just knew how to be respectful of their family unit and enter it, not only enter it, but enter it that I knew we were bringing a baby into it. And my relationship with Carrie was wonderful. She was one of the smartest people and most complicated and great people. And she said to Ava one day, which was fantastic. Ava must have been three. She's like, you know, I'm Princess Leia and you don't know this now. That's really, really cool. One day you're going to know that's
it's
really
very
cool.
Important, like for real.
Right. You know, and it worked. I mean, I will have to say it really worked. And of course it's a tragedy that Carrie passed away, and it was a huge loss for our family and certainly for Billy. And we used to call ourselves, or I still do, the Royal Tannenbaums, because it's just like, I mean, I'm like, hey, like, this is your family. It's insane.
It's so good. I mean, Jesus, like, what, like, a rich family history, and it's incredible. Like, your daughter's very
yeah.
lucky that she's growing up with such, like, a fulfilling cultural universe and interesting
Completely.
People.
Yes. And you could see that about her. She had some incredible smart people. So, you know, her time with Carrie, and she'd be with Carrie and Billy and Debbie and, you know, or Brian and us and a lot of adults and interesting people. And it was, you know, I went from this gay guy running around New York in my 30s, like, woohoo! We opened Palm West in 1999 in the theater district. It was nutso. And that's where we were all, like, Andy and I, through that, I mean, I became friends with Joe Mantello in the early 90s, with Sarah Jessica Parker, with Natasha Richardson, with John Hickey. Like, we had fun. We had, like, all my friends were show folk. The fact, I mean, I guess I am show folk adjacent, but it was really an incredible time that I think, unfortunately, we're not going to see the likes of for a long time again. And yet again, I also feel one of the things that was a killer in New York was the disparity in income. And I hope that one of the things that shifts is it all sort of comes back into some sort of line where you can have a middle class that lives in New York City, that young artists can live in New York City, that young people can live in New York City, that you don't have to make a gazillion dollars and be a, you know, a douchebag on Wall Street to live in New York City.
Yeah. Speaking of LA, did you know Lisa Vanderpump from the restaurant industry at all?
No, I met Lisa through Andy. I met Lisa Rinna through Andy, Kyle through Andy. I had like just a real connection with Rinna, a nice, really lovely connection with Richard, a great connection with Dorinda. Carol Radwell was a very good friend of mine for many years before, you know, she was on it and off it. You know, no, like LVP and I, like we sort of circled each other through. And then, of course, we threw that epic baby shower at the Palm in Beverly Hills, which was insane.
Let's talk about the baby shower. So I was trying to think, like, what could we possibly talk about that hasn't already been covered to death? But I want to hear from your perspective the stressors around all the different moving parts and the cogs in the wheel to put on that type of event, which was going to have a guest list full of a lot of personalities.
To say the least, right? I mean, to say the least, when the Atlanta Housewives walked in, it was like the movie stars walked into that room. It was just like they looked beautiful, and it was just... So Kyle Richards really put that thing together. You know, the Palm was the backdrop. Kyle put, you know, event planners in, and she's incredibly talented when it comes to that. Her eye is fantastic. So we created this whole space. The stress level for me was tremendous, and it kind of turned out to be like a two-part day. So it's like the arrivals, and people were sort of like gentrified. It was one big long table, and people were sort of sitting wherever. There was a little bit of a quadrant for Andy, like in like his main seat. And then interesting how what women, you know, were kind of sitting near him. I would say it was a lot of Beverly Hills and some New York, you know, and then as you went, no, actually, I think Beverly Hills was farther down. And then lunch happened, and it was all really nice.
Civilized.
And I was like, okay. But I, you know, as a restaurateur who's ran many rooms at the Palm and many events, I just was, you know, I can never fully relax because it was my backdrop. Then it got like 2 or 3 hours in. I'm like, okay, well, this is pretty mellow. And for whatever reason, like the booze kicked in. And then the energy started to go up, and I was like, oh, shit. And like then Rinna saying, you know, everyone get the F on the table, you housewives, you motherfucker, blah, 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 blah. And like now you have these women, like there was these women on a four top, you know, a booth. And I'm holding the base of it because just bam, face plant,
yeah.
Cosmetic surgery all over the floor, you know, not pretty. And I'm like, the tables are going like this. You could see I'm just a mess. Like, I can't enjoy it, but like everyone's having a great time. And it was just one of those epic night, evenings. And we'll go down in history. And I say everyone brought their best game. And he was so ecstatic. And so it was great. And they did a Radio Andy to have a little booth for it. So, which was my idea, FYI.
Oh, wow.
I was like, can I do it? He's like, no, you don't know enough about them. And I was like, great, I can't.
Do you actually watch The Housewives?
Not really. I used to watch New York, and I would watch Beverly Hills. And the problem was, I find it so incredibly stressful. And I just get very anxious, and I can't do it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But yes, I'm not a big fan.
But Bruce, it's ironic because you have been lobbying to be the first gay house husband of Beverly Hills.
Isn't this
not your dream?
Yes, it was my dream. Well, first of all, when Andy first threw it out there, he was like, you should be, of course. I would be like, oh my God, I just ran into Lisa Vanderpump at Barney's. And he'd be like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I was at shopping. He's like, this is what you need to do. And Brian would say, the minute you do it, it's the minute I divorce you.
Oh,
and I was like, okay, well, season one, I get a divorce. Okay, that's a good storyline. I'm like, let's do it, Andy. And Andy would be like, da, da, da. But it was not, you know, and it was funny because we talked about it the other day, and I feel like with my nephew, and I go, we're on the other side of that. Like that moment in time, which would have been great for the Palm, maybe great for the, you know, Mugen, which is the company, but never going to happen, Justin. Never.
Do you think that there should or ever will be a man on the Housewives, like a gay male housewife or house husband?
I'm amazed that that hasn't happened. It will be heartbreaking for me. But yes, I think there should be a man house. There should be a gay housewife. It's like not meant to be demeaning to call a man a housewife, but you know, in the fact that men are, you know, gay men can be married, such a, and so many gay people love these shows. So I think it's way past the time because they all have their gay best friends or their gay friends that are coming or going and their stuff like that. So to actually have, and I know they've tried shows with all gay men to do it, but it doesn't quite have the same thing. But yeah, like I should be pulling up in my, I don't know what my tagline would be, you know, as I do my, my turn holding my diamond, but it would be fun.
I think the argument, because there's a lot of conversation around this idea of like a gay man joining the cast. And I think the argument around it is that, no, this is a show. I don't feel either way about it. I think, hell, like anything to liven it up, anything for fresh energy and entertainment. That's all I care about.
Right.
Like
right,
I'm very much too. Of the mind, the biggest crime you commit, you can commit is to not be entertaining. Like that's,
exactly.
That is my
right.
own take.
Right, right.
But other voices in the fandom, what I've heard is like, no, this is a show about women and you can watch men everywhere else. And like, it should only be women, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, this is the
problem. I agree.
I mean, I kind of feel like they're taking it a little bit too seriously. So I understand, okay, this is a show about women, but is it really just a show about women? How many women are like that? You know what I mean? And actually you can argue and there are people that have problem with what, how they treat each other and how they act. So, you know, if it's really a comedy, because that the Housewives is a comedy. I mean, that's what it is. It's a TV show that's a comedy. And why not throw into the mix a Real Housewife of Beverly Hills and have the first, you know, gay relationship be, and it's a housewife. And I mean, I get it. And it, I guess it bleeds into sort of, it's a man's world and Me Too and a white man's world and all that stuff. And it gets so complicated, but at the end of the day, like you, I feel like let's just have some fun and it's not meant to be taken so seriously.
Yeah. Just like a final note about the Housewives. I remember a few years ago, gosh, I don't know how, maybe it was like 4 or 5 years ago. I remember there were paparazzi photos of Bethany on the beach in Miami. And it said, Bethany spotted with a mystery, with like a hot, hunky mystery man. And it was you.
I know. I was in good shape. That, I mean, I looked at that picture. I was really like jacked. And it was me. That's what happens. It's like, I'm the hot mystery man. Then it's like, oh, gay husband of, and immediately gets not. But yeah, she was there. I was there. We were walking on the beach and she was very funny. So we're walking down from my hotel to her house. She was staying at the Soho House. And as we're walking, she can spot the paparazzi. So she goes to me, she turns around. Okay. She's like, are you ready? Okay. Like, watch this. Okay. And so as we go and we turn around, it's like, bam, you know, click, 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 click. Like she know, like she's a professional. Like she's the OG. Like, she's really the queen of, she really is the queen of the franchise. And yes, I was the hot one. And yet again, Brian Moore was like, really? Do you have to? And I'm like, yeah, I do. Like, this is fun, you know?
Are you friendly with Bethany? Like, have you like seen her at all lately?
I haven't seen her. We did recently text. She texted me in regard to something Palm related. And I said, we weren't involved in it anymore. Maybe we'll have a glass of rosé. I'll come over. We'll do some. So she was like, that would be great. So maybe in the next like 2 or 3 weeks, we'll hopefully connect.
I love you.
Thank you. This is a joy.
I could talk, talk to you all night. I love you. Because I know that there are so many more stories in you.
I was just about to say that. There's really a lot of good juicy ones in there. We're just skimming the surface. And we might need like a part 2, part 3 at some point.
I love it. Bruce, tell everyone where they can follow you on Instagram.
So, and first of all, I want to know every way how to, you know, get the word out that I was on your show today. Because this is fantastic. Really simple. My Instagram is Bruce Bozzi.
There's so much more I want to talk to you about. I'm pretty sure I can get like 10 more Madonna stories out of you.
You really can. You definitely can get. They're there.
I'll let you know.
They're there.
Everyone, please follow me, JessXNYC, on Instagram or on YouTube. And we'll see you next week.